thank you for this chus to be able to say words of Torah in front of Rabbi Miller. Rabbi Miller's father was my Rav, my Shul growing up, and I have beautiful memories of the Bronx and King's Mishpat Jewish Center, and to share Torah with you in a place I learned in this very room over about 35 years ago. So this brings very many, many old memories and feelings together. So I thank you for this opportunity. I went through a few different titles. I'm not sure which one was actually posted, but this is the one that I had originally worked with. I was asked to say a few words about how to best use our great Tanakh and great sources, while our Chazal are telling us that to learn Gemara is ain mida gedola mizu, but to learn Tanakh, the Gemara Mitzia says mida ve'ino mida, and even the one who revolutionized the study of Tanakh explains a statement Rabbi Eliezer makes to his students, Menu b'neichem in ahigoyon, Rashi writes in Daf Chav Ches Maseches Brachos, Al targilum b'mikro yosem midai mishum d'mashcha. The Tanakh will drive you away from the more important studies that we have to take to heart. But be aware that when it says Hamisha l'mikra, the Mishnah was hoping that by the time you get to be 10, you finish, and now you can move on to Mishnah, and by the time you're 15, you can move on to Gemara. There are some programs here in Eretz Yisrael, I'm told, that actually study this way. They finish Mikra by the age of 10, and they only study Mishnah, and they have a firm foundation. So now, you, everyone here knows Tanakh. Yeah, you know it the way it's quoted in the Gemara, or maybe Tosfos. But the foundation was meant to be in a different direction. So, as someone who teaches in an institution that has as its motto, Torah Umada, Mada simply being the Aramaic word for Da'as. So if Torah Mada is a problem, Torah Da'as is a problem. But Mada is what the Tanakh says that Shlomo had as part of his engagement of wisdom. It's also what Nebuchadnezzar wanted to have when he put especially Daniel and his friend in front of him in his court. So I devised some makoros that go through these 15 items. I have 1 hour, so we have to get on our and get moving. And then at the end, I prepared some materials for you to use when creating curriculum for if you're teaching in high school or in day school, some materials you can use. I think this one is specifically for high schools. But first, let's start with turn everything around, and you'll see a page that says the best of Torah Mada using common knowledge in the service of Jewish studies, in this case, in the service of understanding certain elements of Tanakh. By all means, in between, at any point, please raise your hand or in. We'll leave time at the end for questions. But let's start with what's written in Yehoshua Perek Yud. Torah says, the Pasuk says that when Yehoshua was prosecuting the battle against Gibeon, he ran into a problem with the day ending and the people were escaping, so he held the sun up in the sky. The Christians persecuted Galileo because he said that in fact there is what is known as the heliocentric theory, not the geocentric theory, and they used this Pasuk to persecute him because of... From Yehoshua Perek Yud, it would appear that in order to make the day last longer, from what Galileo was saying, he should have said that the earth should stop spinning. Instead, he said the sun stop revolving, stop turning. And in Koheles, it says that the sun turns and spins around the earth. So how do we reconcile these issues with what we learn in science? Whether you teach here or whether you teach in America, you will run into issues of this sort. And there are different approaches to take from the Torah Umada standpoint. Is that you can say that the two don't interact. You can say that the Torah cares about morality and our practice, and the Torah isn't written from a standpoint of teaching us issues of creation and the like. Rashi seems to say that all over his parish to the beginning of Bereshis. The Torah is not here to tell me the Seder HaBriya, it's here, and Rashi seems to be pointing in the direction of learning morality from the way the trees were created, from the way the sun and the moon was created. Not interested in the intricate details of creation. If you would look at Sumerian, Babylonian, and Egyptian descriptions of creation, how we came to be, because man has always been trying to resolve the question of why are we here, how did we get here, and what are we supposed to do while we're here, is that they were interested in explaining these questions in terms of service of the gods, and in terms of you see a very, very creative approaches to how the planets came to be, the sun and the moon. The Torah just says, don't worry about those things. The observant Jew and the high school Tanakh teacher should be more interested in teaching his student not how we came to be here, but why we came to be here. And that's a question of morality. So the fact is that if you look in the front page of the newspaper, it told you this morning when the sun rose. That doesn't mean that the sun is rising. It just means that the Tanakh tells us information from the standpoint of the human observer, and it's not here to give me scientific information. So this pasuk in Bereishis describing the size of the moon or the sun, or what's the reflector, what's the larger, what's the smaller, these are not questions that should really concern us. And I think Rashi's Perush to the Torah makes that point very clearly. So when it comes to things such as the age of the universe or other things of that sort, there are some excellent works now being written by great physicists who are Balei Tshuva, who try to show from using the Big Bang Theory to other things like of that sort to reconcile with Pesukim and Tanakh. Again, you can say that I don't want to engage this issue. It's not my it's not the Tanakh's problem. The Tanakh is not a book of science. Or you can say if you want to engage the issue, then I think that there are plenty of works out there by Avi Ezri and others, and I'm sure that's if you want to go in that direction. Right? There are those who say that because time and space are relative, so very early after the Big Bang, each second right after the Big Bang aged the universe hundreds of millions of years. And then slowly, each second is less, 20 million, then 10 million, then 5 million. So that explains how the scientist says that we have such an old-looking universe out there. And besides, Chazal say, Ki biyo Hashem tzur olamim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created many worlds, and we're in one of them. So we better behave so we stay in this one. All right, so the question is, that just number one, is that we are within the realm of how to engage Pesukim and Tanakh that seem to move that question certain scientific notions of evolution, astronomy, we should be able to just give the right answer to the high school student. Let's move to three, which is archaeology. I mentioned this came up coincidentally in the last class I gave in Shraga, was that there's only one major city in all of this country that has no cataclysmic interruption of its history. In other words, if you dig into ground in Chatzor, you dig into the ground in Beersheba, you dig into ground in major cities that were inhabited at the time of the conquest of Canaan, you will find a cataclysmic event. Something looks like a volcano, something destroyed the place. Except Givon. Givon is the only city that has no... Again, someone may find it, if you keep digging deeper and deeper, you may find that 500 years before Yahushua conquered Canaan, someone wiped out an entire area. But Kamash Malam, that Givon has not produced at the time of the conquest any such recognition because Givon made peace with Bnei Israel. So there was no destruction of that place. Now, I must admit when you're teaching Yahushua someplace, I think Yahushua must be taught with archaeology and certainly geography of the land. The question is for you, there are some books that are written purposely from an archaeological standpoint to disprove Tanakh. Obviously, you're not going to use those works. The question is, it's an intellectual question. Do I have the right delving into a theme, which is number three here, where some people use this scientific notion to disprove Tanakh? Do I have the intellectual right to use the parts of archaeology that can help me be a better teacher to high school students in Tanakh? And I think the answer is yes. I think if you just look at the example I gave you on this page, where in Shmuel Aleph, we're describing a certain sharpening process of weapons. The pasuk says, "Va'isaha p'tzira pim l'machareishas u'la'esim." You see it? Can you see the situation was the problem was that Bnei Yisrael were so bereft of ability to prosecute battle that when they first fought the Plishtim, when Shaul was just crowned king, they had to use farming implements as weapons. And the pasuk described how they would sharpen these farming implements. And it says, "Hapitzirapim." Rashi writes that these two words mean that they would sharpen the serrated edges of these sickles or other tools of katsira in order to use them in battle. So Rabbi Yosef Kara cites this Rashi and says, I don't know what pim is either. It's a hapax legamina, means it's a word that appears only once in the Tanakh. Ein lamila zuchaber. But he says that it seems to me the plural of peh is not pim, it's piyot. Should have been hapitzira shel hapiyot or something like that. But okay, Rashi writing that it's the plural of peh shows that the word is very difficult. I mean, hard to understand what it means. But we have just found a number of stones, a large picture of this stone. There are only six available to us now. And this stone has the word pim spelled in Ksav Ivri. Yerushalmi refers in Maseches Megillah to the Aseres Adibros being given to us in Ksav Ivri. And it says there, not the mem b'samach shebaluchos b'nei sayyomdim, but ayin shebaluchos b'nei sayyomim. Because the ayin is an I, it's hieroglyphic, it's a circle letter. So Yerushalmi suggests an opinion that the original language was Ksav Ivri, and that Ezra, Ksav Anishtavon, Zohar Gemara in the Sanhedrin refers to this possibility that Ezra changed the letters. The Bavli in Megillah says Shokum B'chazim B'yostim. It was originally Ksav Ashuri. It was changed to Ksav Ivri, and then Ezra brought it back to Ksav Ashuri. But in this stone, as in most archaeological finds containing the Hebrew language, you can see the pei, and it's a little smudged here, pei yud, and a very clear-looking mem, on the size of this stone. It is, I have held one. It is exactly two-thirds, it was six, on a diamond scale, 0.677128 of a shekel. We have many hundreds of ancient shkolim, but only six pim. So I think it might be actually, for this might help us understand a different parshanut. In other words, without this stone, it would be very difficult to really figure out what this word means. I think it's one word in Shmuel. But I think it might shed light on another area of Tanakh, which is where Elisha asked Eliyahu to be twice as great as him. You all know the story, right? Eliyahu said, "You ask for something difficult. If you see me when I go up to Shemayim, you'll get what you want." The Gemara clearly, in a number of places, understands this to mean that he asked to be twice as great. Because a few times the Gemara talks about Elisha reviving two people being revived from the dead because of Elisha, and they say because Eliyahu did one, so Elisha must do two. The second maybe wasn't that man who rose from the grave, but maybe the cure of Naaman, who was Saras, who was Tzarua, and the Tzarua Chashuv Kemes, so that he has to revive two while Eliyahu revived one. However, I would like to suggest that the words, when he said, "I want to be pishnayim of your greatness," Elisha was not asking to be twice as great, but he was asking to be two-thirds as great. And here might be the key to understand what this means. When the Torah speaks about a man with two sons, the older son gets pishnayim. Everyone translates that as a double portion. True, that the older son always gets a double portion, but when there are two sons, as in the pasuk, he gets two-thirds, and the other son gets a third, right? The only other place in Tanakh where the word pishnayim appears, again by Nachala, when Elisha asks, "I want to be pishnayim of you, Eliyahu," a third time, it clearly means two-thirds. Where Zechariah refers to two-thirds of the Jews doing this, and the remaining third doing that, right? Some modern commentaries refer this pasuk to the Holocaust, where two-thirds of European Jewry were murdered. But be that as it may, it's clear at the end of Zechariah that pishnayim means two-thirds. This coin is almost exactly two-thirds of a shekel. It may be that the word pim was a shortened form of pishnayim shekel. So not only can we, through this archaeological find of this small little stone, determine it's a weight, it's a measure. Shekel is a measure, a pim is two-thirds of a shekel. Not only can we determine what is a pim, we can determine why it's called a pim. That might help us understand that Elisha wasn't being such a chutzpedik to Eliyahu to say, I want to be twice as great as you. He was saying, I want to be two-thirds as great as you. And even that was a lot to ask, which Eliyahu said. So the question here is, what right do I have to give this perush if Chazal already in a few Gemaras, in Sanhedrin, in Zvochim, say that it means twice as great? So herein lies a deep question. Can I say pshat of something against Maimar Chazal? The answer is, of course you can, because there's Shivim Panam LaTorah. But in this case, can you say Elu ve'elu? Can you say a different perush of something that goes against the Gemara? So Rashi in his Perush al HaTorah does this often if it's not Achar Yishuvo Shel Mikra. He doesn't mean Chas V'Shalom, it doesn't mean that the Gemara is wrong. He means that the Gemara is not pshat. Right? Okay, I'll give a quick example of this. Rashi in Kiddushin Daf Mem Tes, where the Gemara talks about a man who wants to be betrothed to a woman because he knows how to lane. The Gemara says he not only must lane, he must read Targum. Just as Targum. So the Gemara says, what Targum? His own Targum? Just translate? No, that's not enough, because if you just translate, you can be Macharef and Magadev, or you could be Bedai if you translate wrong. Right? So the Gemara's conclusion is you must, in order to be married, do Targum Didon. You have to say Targum Onkelos. That's the Gemara. Rashi writes, because Targum Onkelos was given at Har Sinai, and if someone explains a pasuk against Targum Onkelos, you can be Machari from Agadev, and he gives an example. The example he gives is Lo Sa'aneh Al Riv. Spell Riv in the pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. Resh Bet. It's missing the Yud. And the Gemara darshins it in Sanhedrin Daf Yud Zayin as if though it's Rav. Lo Sa'aneh Al Rav, which the Gemara uses to prove how we should start voting on the Sanhedrin from this pasuk. Lo Sa'aneh Al Riv is darshin Geshem Lemesora as if though the Yud isn't there, as if though the word is Rav. And Rashi cites this Targum Onkelos. He says that if the would-be chosen translates Lo Tasid Al Dina, Eina Mekudeshes, because he translated Lo Sana Al Riv according to his own Pshuto Shalmikra, not according to the Mesorah of Targum Onkelos. Why am I telling you all this? Because in Rashi's Perush Al HaTorah, in Parshas Mishpatim, on the Pasuk Lo Sa'ane Al Riv, he cites this Targum Onkelos and writes afterwards, Eino Acha Yeshuvo Shel Mikra, this is the Pshat of Lo Sa'ane Al Riv. Rashi essentially called himself Macharif Makadif. In Kiddushin Daf Mem Tes Amad Aleph, he said that it's also to explain this Pasuk, not like Targum Onkelos. Rashi explains many Pesukim in the Torah like Targum Onkelos. Why didn't he use an example? He wrote his Perush al Torah much earlier than his Perush al Shas. He knew that he purposely used an example of a pasuk where he disagrees with Targum Onkelos and Pshat. When Rashi disagrees, and he disagrees with Onkelos and Pshat about 500 times in his Perush al Torah, sometimes while saying so, sometimes without saying so. What does Rashi mean in those 500? Chas V'Shalom doesn't mean Onkelos is wrong. He's just saying Onkelos is not the Pshat. There's Pshat and there's 69 other ways to read the Torah. Alright, clear? So by saying that the word Pim is this new interpretation that we only find now through this archaeological find. Alright, so this you see what you have beneath that is a picture of what's known as the Mesha stone. You should all be aware of this. Because the Mesha stone has produced an ancient language that is absolutely the closest language to Hebrew of anything that exists in the ancient world. If you read what I gave you on the side is a Hebrew transliteration of what's on this stone. Just the first three lines. This is by far and away the most significantly large archaeological find to date. It's about 150 years old. It's known as the Mesha stone and was available to... It exists. It's in the Louvre and there are copies here in Eretz Yisrael. You find them in the Shrine of the Book. And you can read the beginning of it. It describes events in Melachim Beis that I wrote down at the bottom of the page. Okay, you see at the far right corner, I wrote the words Tosefes Bracha Rus Perek Aleph. He wants to give a chiddush. Tosefes Bracha is the Torah Tamima. He wrote a perush to Rus where in the Tosefes Bracha, the Torah Tamima also has on Chamesh Megillos. But the Tosefes Bracha says, I wonder why Perek Aleph of Rus is filled with so many masculine pronouns. It's a story of three women and they're constantly referred to as men. Right? So there must be a drash here someplace. Right? When Rechav and Baana kill Ishbosheth, it describes them leaving the palace with a feminine pronoun, Heina. Not Heima, but Heina. So they presented the head of Ishbosheth to David. How did they get the head out of the palace? How did they get the king's head out of the palace? They got in by killing some wheat sellers, and they went, but how do you get out of a palace with a head, king's head? Can you guess? Under their shirt. Get it? Okay, they dressed up as women. So when Ruth and Naomi and Orpah are called men, it says it's shtehem. Imochem, yas Hashem imochem, kasher asisem. They're constantly referred to as men. So Rus Rabba says that the trip from Moab through the Gaona Yarden to Beis Lechem Yehuda was a very dangerous one, and they dressed up as men. For three women to travel alone through Gaona Yarden, impossible at that time. So they dressed up as men, and that's why that the Tanakh gives you this hint. It's not the way of the Tanakh to say so vayitzchapsu ke'anashim. It's not the way of Tanakh to do that. It tells you this through a male pronoun. That's the welcome to the world of drash. So Josephus Bracha says, it seems to me that when they were living for 10 years in Moab, that in the Moabite language we don't differentiate between masculine and feminine. So they got so used to speaking just like in English, right? You say he walked, she walked. So because of that, the first parak does not differentiate, and it just calls them like men. So if the Torah Tzmima lived into the '30s, lived in New York, died in New York, he should have known this. Moabite does differentiate between masculine and feminine, just like Hebrew does. So that's not a good answer. We have to go back to what Chazal say. So the Meshech Sloan does reveal to us some fascinating aspects of an ancient language that is very similar to Hebrew. Now, Chazal used Greek to explain difficult Hebrew words, right? Right. So it says in the Torah, a man is with his wife and her mother. It says, kill him and them. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, that both of them? One of those women is certainly a rogue, but her daughter or her mother is not. Right? You know what I'm saying? Why do we have to kill both of them? So the Gemara has a few drushes, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Ishmael. One of those drushes is, eshen means eshen. Greek, hen is one. One hen. Right? Kill him and one of them. It's using Greek to make, the Gemara is filled with drushes like this. The creates hador is hydra, the Gemara in Sukkah, because it grows near water, so it's hador from the Greek word hydra. Or the Gemara in Menachos, totafos, from two African words. Now, that's Chomite and Yefet languages. How much more so should it be within the realm of the possible to use Shemite, Semitic languages, of which Moab surely is one. Ugaritic and then Akkadian and other such languages to use to help us with difficult Hebrew words, right? So that is framework of our knowledge. Let's look at mathematics. There's something. You know what? This is just from the standpoint of gematria, but I'll just say a few quick words on this. You can use the examples. You can see them yourselves. When Ibn Ezra cites. He doesn't cite Rashi by name. Ibn Ezra only cites Rashi by name twice in his whole Perush al HaTorah. But sometimes he cites what Rashi says in the name of someone else or in the name of Chazal. And Ibn Ezra on the pasuk where Avraham says that 318 men went with Avraham, it was really Eliezer. So it's not just the amazing coincidence that the only man we could identify by name there has exactly the same gematria. That wasn't might not have been enough for Rashi to write that it was just Eliezer going with Avraham. It's the unusual number. There's no number like 318 in the Torah. The Torah, by its normal approach, should have said 300 men went with Avraham. Right? The Torah rounds things off. There's a Rosh at the end of Pesachim that gives a few examples of things like this, where the Torah rounds off. Of course, the Chazal have drushes. It's Yocheved that makes number 70. Other specificities, but in each case, the Rosh says that it could be that the Torah is just rounding off. So when Rashi sees a number like 318, he had the darshan. On that pasuk, Ibn Ezra writes, "We don't do gematria. The Torah never speaks pederach gematria, and And therefore, because if you had enough time to spend or waste, then you would be able to do anything you want, good or bad, using gematria. Right? So that's Ibn Ezra. But the fact is that the Tanakh definitely does speak with Derech gematria. How do I know? When Yirmiyahu doesn't want his readers to know he's talking about Bavel, what does he call Bavel? Someone, I just heard someone say it. Sheshach. Sheshach. Right? That's gematria. In fact, if you ever saw the Perush of the Rokeach al HaTorah, with Rav Chaim Kanevsky's notes, he writes 63 different types of gematrias. What is gematria, after all? It's code. You encode. I don't want you to give me the word Bavel, so I'm going to write Sheshach. It's Atbash. The Rokeach refers to Soma, Albam, Atbach, Ashbar. He has all kinds of different gematrias of that sort. Right? We think of gematria as Aleph is a 1, a Yud is a 10. That's much more than that. Right? So yeah, I think Ibn Ezra has to be shown that the Tanakh definitely does speak with gematria. Right? When Yirmiyahu wants to speak, refer to the Kastim, he doesn't want them to know he's talking about the Kastim. He refers to an unknown country called Lev Kamoi. Lev Kamoi. He refers to those words a number of times in his books, in Sefer Yirmiyahu. And if you're not steeped in what he's doing, you wonder, what is a Lev Kamoi? Right? Targum Yonason says Kastai. Right? So there were definitely gematria. So I'll leave this. There's a lot of creativity in this, and I think we have to be wise in how carefully we do this. When it comes to geometry, I have a picture here for you.
How does the
Kamash
enter
into Atbash? The lamed is mem. I'm sorry. Lamed is chof. Beis is the second letter. Shin is the second to last. You figure that. Leiv Kamoi is custom. Okay, as far as geometry, I just want to use my time properly, but I just want to take a look at turn the page, just... you see in the middle of the page there, it says, you see some diagrams. And Sukkot al-Chesam with Beis. Rashi and Tosfos try to prove. I skipped over the Yamsha Shlomo, but I'll come back to it. Rashi tries to prove. Rashi and Tosfos that you see the diagram. You see, look on the left. You see a circle that's inscribed within a square, and there's a square within the circle. Right? The Gemara there is trying to prove. Get this: that the area between the small square and the large square. Those are two circles exactly the same size. I just took this out of the Gemara. You see, the Tosfos is right there. Right? You see, there's the same size circle. It's a famous optical illusion that the circle on the top looks bigger, right? So, but it's the same size circle, but that the Tosfos wants to prove about regarding the amount of people who can sit in such a sukkah, right? That the area between the two squares is the same. Right? It's a beautiful example of afochpa v'afochpa. And it's very difficult to try to prove such a thing from the eye. Because the area between the two squares seems to be much more inside the square than outside the square. So what does Rashi tell you to do? Hafochba. Don't look at the square, two squares, one next to the other. Turn the square into a diamond. That's the picture on the right. That's the picture that appears in Rashi. Right? Turn the square on. You see what he does on the right? Turn it into a diamond, and now the square touches the four sides of the larger square, right? Now you see very clearly, any simple geometry theorem from 10th grade is going to prove that the square on the inside is the same as the square on the outside. Because you have four triangles on the inside that are equal to the four triangles on the outside, right? It was just Rashi using a simple geometrical notion in order to prove what the Gemara spent a lot of time trying to figure this out. Right? The Gemara took it for granted, but didn't explain itself. Right? Rashi, it's a beautiful example of hafochba, hafochba. Just turning it on the side, you know, hafochba. Just turn it a little bit. Now, what's the thing at the top? The Yam Shel Shlomo, which was amazingly on top of some molten bulls. If you hadn't heard this before, you're not even going to believe me. But this is a picture from the Beis HaMikdash. These molten bulls. This is a tzura, right? But this is what the water receptacles stood on in the Beis HaMikdash, right? This is not from a Medrash. This is what's written in Divrei Yomim, okay? this is a picture. It's about to size. That's a person on the side, right? And it was known in Hebrew as Yam Shel Shlomo, right? The problem is that the description of the size of this Yam Shel Shlomo is so far off in terms of geometry. It says it was a perfect circle, 30 amos in circumference and 10 amos across the middle. So the Ralbag says some simplest pshat. What would you say is the simplest pshat to explain this discrepancy? Because the ancient man knew that pi was, the Egyptians were working with 22 over 7, which is crude by our standards, but certainly better than 3, right? So why is Shlomo working with 3? He must have had good building techniques. Why is he working with a pi of 3? The answer is, Ralbag says, because what we said before, by rounding off. It's not the way of Tanakh to write that the diameter was 10 and the circumference was 31.4. Or the diameter was 30 and the circumference was 30 and the diameter was 9.62. It's not the way of Tanakh to do that. Right? So it rounds off. So comes the Vilna Gaon and he says, if we go back to the page before this, back in the pages of mathematics, you see that? All those numbers. So it says Vayas Esayam. First of all, do you know what this number is on top of that? This is the beginning of pi. Pi goes on out of tonight, right? But the word for the circumference in the pasuk is a kriyaksiv. It's vikav. Anyone have a calculator on a phone or right? We just do this quickly. But the word for diameter, vikav and kava. Okay, so he tells you the gematria is, this is 111, this is 106. So if you do this, okay, take the pi of the pasuk, take the ratio of the kri and the ksiv, and you will get, this is amazing, they were working with 22 over 7, which is 3.14, and then wildly goes away from pi, to a significant proportion. But if you take this what I take at the top of the page, kava over kav, times 3, let's say the Vilna Gaon to figure this out, you get to a number of these decimal points. It goes way as soon as you get to the 6th or 7th decimal point, all right, any veering off of that is not significant anymore. It's 1/100,000th. But 22 over 7, again, which was what the Egyptians were working with, veers off right away. It's 3.14, and it instead of 1, it's like 7 or 8. That's a significant change. And it was enough for them at that time. But here is a way how the Groth says, right there hinted in the Kriyat Siv. Now, this is significant because in the Rishonim, you have a lot of controversy about this. The Radak and the Abravanel claim that Kriyat Siv, one is right and one is wrong. Because Ezra wasn't sure which one belonged, so he put them both in. Gemara Nedarim says, Adrabba, Kri Belo Ksiv, what does Gemara say there in the Lamed Zion? It says, Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. There's something to be learned from both of them. We learn Halachas from Kri Ksiv, Ashalof Hama, and Meseches Megillah, and Meseches Arachin. So these are our crucial issues. All right, let's quickly move to the next thing. All right, history, I tell you, you won't be able to do justice to the beginning of Meseches Rosh Hashanah unless you know the history of the Persian dynasties. I'm not going to go too much more on that. With respect to anthropology, what can I say? The Torah understands man perfectly. You must take every opportunity you can. One day you'll have shoals, you'll be teaching high school kids. It's crucial to be showing them that when the Torah writes, Zeh Sefer Toldos Ha'adam, what does Ramban write on that pasuk? We're not talking about the history of man. This every word, every reference, every sentence is what I was just looking at something that my daughter-in-law was showing me something I wrote in Parshas Vayetze, that it says when Yaakov was working for Rachel, it says, they went by like a few days because what? Explain, what do the next two words mean in Hebrew? Because Kuni says, ba'avaso osa refers because he loved the work. He was working for the first time. He was busy in yeshiva. This is his first job. So he loved Ba'avaso Osa, because otherwise, if it was Rachel the pasuk is talking about, then this should have taken 7 years, should have felt like 70 years. I don't know if 7 days will feel like 70 years. But if you like what you're doing in the interim, so the Chizkuni discusses this, but that's what we do in drushes. We show how every word of the Torah is drenched with information of the human condition. Soloveitchik was very good at showing us this, and it's crucial to show that the Torah was very, very well aware of man. And while the Torah allows for and tolerates something like, let's say, slavery or polygamy, a time may come where, as a result of changes in society and changes of social understanding, that we will not only refrain from doing what the Torah allows, but put it under the ban, as Rabbeinu Gershom did. So we'll see that we are it's crucial to present these issues appropriately and before the Balabatim. Right? I wrote down here forensics because there's something very, very interesting about the way that Goliath dies. Many, I told you before that some archaeologists are going to be presenting the archaeology because they have an axe to grind. They want to take the axe and chop up every word of Tanakh and show that it doesn't exist and it's wrong. Forensic experts have shown that the way David kills Goliath proves that. Because Goliath, it says, fell on his face. Goliath should have fallen on his back the way he was hit. It's the same technology and science that goes into which direction Kennedy was shot from because of what happened to him after he was shot. The difference is very simple. If the shot killed him instantly, he reacted exactly as he should have. If the shot did not kill him, then he might do something like this for a few seconds, and then the brain conks out. And right? So here's a fascinating thing. For Goliath to have grown as tall as the Tanakh calls him, he must have been suffering from a pituitary disorder they call giantism. And giantism makes you grow until you can't grow any longer, and the first thing that gives in, they call it an Achilles heel. It's not. It's the Achilles skull. The first thing that gives in is right here. Someone as tall as him could have been killed by any one of you just pressing your thumb through there, cracking his skull. To grow as tall as he was, which is by our standards now something in the order of 9.5 feet. Now, Hashem can make people grow as tall as you want, right? It's like, oh, Melech HaBashan if you want. But I'm just saying, in a natural order, for him to grow 6 amos and a zeres, he must have been suffering from this and lasted longer than most people have ever lasted. David's stone that hit him where the Tanakh says it hit him killed him before he fell. That's why he fell that way. But if it didn't, if something like that would hit him over there, right? And he was protected there. It didn't matter. Surely he was wearing a guard there. It says he was wearing saronim all over his body. But anything that would just touch there would make him die immediately, in which case he didn't have time to catch his feet one way or the other, and he just crumpled down And that's why actually the picture here from Isaac Doré has him just like the Tanakh says, right? You see him lying flat down, which is an interesting thing in forensics. Let me tell you, by the time you get up to this, 9, 10, by the time you get up to these points, I think if you give this as a Tanakh shir, your first class for your 11th grade Tanakh shir, I think you will sell them immediately. You have them. They want to see these things because they learn a lot of these things in their. And I must say, forgive me if this is just an observation, is that a lot of the high schools are challenging them more in their physics classes. I'm saying Tanakh now. And the Rav Soloveitchik spoke about this very much also, is that they're challenging them more in some of these their afternoon courses than in a Tanakh class. A Tanakh is an orphan. But if you will go out there and you will be teaching Tanakh, show them some of this, and you will get them engaged, you'll get them interested, you'll see how Tanakh touches all these other areas, because the Borei knows how these issues connect to everything in our lives. With respect to politics, you know, I just wrote Shmuel Beis. You know, I think we'd be doing a disservice to David if we didn't explain some of the things he does in Shmuel Beis from the standpoint of being a wise politician. There are 3 times where the death of a person is very good news for David. You know, the halacha says that never when someone loses a parent from whom they will inherit, then they have to make 2 brachas, right? questioning, you know, the Geshur Chaim has a long section where he discusses whether we should make the Shechiyonu while he's still in Aninu Sunnah. Most in the Gemara and Brachas is that he makes the two Brachas one after the other. But no, the Maskunas of Poskim is that Baruch Dayan Emes is while you're an Onim, but the Shechiyonu upon inheriting money should not be made, maybe probate or something. Anyway, but the issue is that David had reason to say Shechiyonu with the death of Shaul, with the death of Avner, and with the death of Ishbosheth. This, each one of these is very good news for him. And in each one, he sings a dirge and cries kinos, and he kills the Rechab and Bano, thought they were going to get a big Yishukah from him. What about that Amaleki in Perek Aleph, who thinks by handing over the crown and jewels and then bracelets, that he's going to get at least the value of those things? He couldn't take them to a pawn shop. What is he giving them to David for? Right? Because he thinks he's going to get more from David for it. David shows at every turn, especially with the death of Avner. And then, but after that, it says, Kol Yisrael knew that David was not behind the killing of Avner. Because remember, David had been with the Plishtim. He fought with the Plishtim twice, for two rounds in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. The average Israelite might have felt, oh, goodness, the Plishtim just killed Shaul. Maybe David helped them. Maybe David gave them information. Chas v'shalom, the reader knows that. But David has to act. A good politician doesn't just say, and by the way, a good Rav also, we're not responsible to judge people b'kav schus, that they will judge us b'kav schus. You want to hear that again? Right? We always have to worry about Maris. Why should I worry about Maris Aaron? You're going to judge me because Chus. Why should I judge you not because Chus that you're going to judge me with Maris Aaron? Because that's the halacha. We don't have to judge people because Chus that they're going to judge us because Chus. So David's political moves in the first four prokim in Sefer Shmuel Beis are so clear, they're so obvious that Tanakh is teaching us politics in Shmuel Beis about how to set up the kingdom properly. All right, David will not have a successful kingdom if people think he was involved or even happy with the death of these people. Right? The Amaleki thought he'd be happy with it. Rechav and Bana thought he'd be happy with it, and he had to teach them otherwise. All right? That's really a crucial point. And it might also be, you know, why did Avner crown Ishbosheth king in the first place? So Chaisvis in the second parak of Sanhedrin suggests that it was to fulfill the oracle of Melachim Mechalatzecha Yitzei, which Rashi mentions in Parshas VeYishlach, but he just wanted to be loyal to his kings. They were relatives, right? So there is room for each book of Tanakh, as you know, can do this, but no book of Tanakh touches this issue as much as politics. Regarding the human condition, and this is a great Sfarim written, you see all the time about husband and wife relationships from stories in the Torah. And look, you know, in these parshios, you have there was a shidduch made for Yitzchak, but Yaakov made his own shidduch, right? Can you do that today? Right? So we say, okay, the answer is there's no one way that has to work for everybody. Right? It depends on the family, depends on the child, depends on the circumstance. So the Torah has and the Tanakh stories have everything we need for in this area. Also, as human condition, the Rashbam refers to this concept. Look in his Perush. Use Rashbam. He's an excellent Pashtan, but underused because he was so critical of Rashi in his Perush. Rashbam was not printed until the 19th century. Right? It sat in a jar for 800 years until the scientific edition came along, and then he started to be printed in Megros Gedolos. But Rashbam refers to something called Derech Eretz, which means something different than what you're used to. He says, "Ein manu achar bekius Derech Eretz klum." He says about Parshas Tazria Mitzora. So he writes, "Go read my mother's father's Perush. Whatever you need to know about Tumah can be found there. I have nothing to say." Because my parish is only Pshat. And when I agree, Pshat fails us sometimes. So if you want to know about the human condition, so go look at my grandpa's parish. But he refers to Derech Eretz as that which can help us understand the Pasuk using human experience. Right? So Tetzu Abanim B'Kir Ba. What does he write? Derech Eretz Hayu Misnanin B'Soch Me'eho K'Derech Ubrim. There's a Kol Gadol when you read Rashbam and Rashi. is that when Rashbam gives a pshat, where Rashi writes, remember how Rashi starts his derish, al korcha hamikra zemer dershuni. Because everywhere people would like to learn pshat first, but here is no pshat, only drash. Shestam mahi ritzitza zuva amra in kein lamazan ochi. So Rashi knew that babies can walk, especially if there's two, move around a little bit, right? But he said in kein lamazan ochi. You don't think that Sarah had problems with being pregnant at 90, or that Rachel had problems pregnancy? She died in pregnancy. In giving birth. So why does the Torah only give Rivka, who ostensibly had the easiest pregnancy? Because this was something extraordinary moving inside of her. Scientists today say that humans conceive twins most of the time. Like animals. More than one. What happens? Is that one struggles, and one doesn't make it. Because they're fighting for nutrients, they're fighting for that's usually usually can be enough. But you know, animals can be trusted to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant for them to do. So they'll carry all that they conceive. But humans don't. We engage in risky behavior. We eat things we shouldn't eat. We smoke things we shouldn't smoke, and we drink things we shouldn't drink. And so they end up that the babies are not getting the nutrients they need. And the woman didn't even realize that she originally conceived to. So by Yisro Tetzuah, Banim Kirbah can actually describe, it's amazing. Remember, Rebbe and Antoninus had a discussion in Perek Chelek about what was going on before birth. How can this happen without a Yitzhar Hara? It could be, like Abravanel says, amazingly in his Perush, that the Yisro Tetzuah, Banim Kirbah means that the Kodesh Baruch Hu worked into our national history that we would have to struggle with Edom. If we don't have to struggle with Edom, we will internally assimilate to become like the Greeks or the Romans or the Hellenists or whatever, Babylonians or Egyptians, that we have to have that struggle. Edom, which is indicative of the outside world, will always cause us to struggle in their midst, so we don't just become like them. You can just to replace Spain or Germany or anything else with that. Look at Abravanel in the beginning of Toldos, he mentions that. So I submit to you that the human condition, again, Rav Soloveitchik was so good at finding this. And when the students see that some of their struggles is what the Rabag explains, and I mentioned Rabag, use him as much as you can. Rabag has every section of his perush to Nevi'im, Torah also, but Nevi'im, it's perhaps more famous, his perush to Torah just has come out recently, he ends each section with, these are the midos, and these are the deos that we learn from this section. A great thing to teach in a high school class. However, here are the 77, sometimes 7, sometimes 37. But various lists of positive reinforcement of what we learn here about this last section. Okay, in the area of psychology, okay, there is another depression of Yirmiyahu in Perek Chof, where he starts off speaking about how he doesn't want to mention Hashem's name anymore. I've had it with God. I can't. I'm going to. Every word I say is a keles and a cherpa, and they try to beat me and kill me. Right before he says this, they punched him and they tried to kill him. And he says, "This is lo adaberod, lo eskorod bishmo." That's finished. I'm finished. And then the next pasuk he says, "Shir Hashem, Haluas Hashem." And he says, "Hashem will save me from my enemies." And he three or four pasukim of that sort. And then the next pasuk, right after that, he says, "Arur hayom asher yiladosni, arur ha'ish asher bisaris avi yolad ishtecha ben, arur, curse the day I was born, curse every minute of my wretched existence." And what's going on here? It's actually a small microcosm of Eicha Perek Gimel, right, where he goes on a roller coaster like this, up and down, up and down, up and down. Right, some pasukim where there's hope, some pasukim where there's no hope, some with hope, some no hope. Ask a survivor of Auschwitz what these two prakim are about. Right? I'm talking about a ma'amin ben ma'amin who survived and can tell you afterwards what that survival was like. With the doubts and the reinforcements and every day you have to bench gomel for a near-death experience. And we make it out and the person can't come, emerges intact. But what happens to Yirmiyahu in Perek Chof that I just described, and what happens to him in Eicha Perek Gimel, is a perfect psychological profile And one shouldn't be afraid to address the Tanakh this way. Of someone who has potential for depression, and even a manic depression, but that gains strength from the last straw that I have to grip from knowing that whatever happens to me, it's part of a plan. So this is I think how we have to present these issues. If I may maybe use one point, the Vilna Gaon says that when Sarah gave over,
how's that chai with the Chazal that telling you receive the Ruah when you're Besimcha?
How he could have received. I don't. This is possibly not every statement made by Yirmiyahu was a result of a nevuah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? I mean, it's very much germane to these parshios now because Yaakov did not receive any nevuah whatsoever from the day Yosef was sold until the day after he found out he was alive, and that's perfectly situated what you're saying to the Rashi that says that he was saying Kriyat Shema exactly when he laid eyes on Yosef. The Ber Yitzchak explains Pshat and Rashi that. But Dafka, he was waiting to see Yosef to recognize what he lost as a result of his atzvos. So it's possible that what we say is that this you know, the Radak in his Hakdama to Tehillim says that Yirmiyahu wrote Eicha with Ruach HaKodesh. He couldn't write it b'Nevuah. So he differentiates between Ruach HaKodesh and Nevi'im. Right? It's between like Nevi'im and Ksuvim. He said Eicha is in Ksuvim and Yirmiyahu he wrote with b'Nevuah. So, but it's certainly a question worthwhile to delve in further. But I want to just finish these last few here. When Sarah gives over a woman to her husband, she says v'ibanem mimena. I'm sorry. She says ulai ibanem mimena. It's Racha that says ibanem mimena. Sforno says on that pasuk, she says I will be zoche to have my own child. Get this. Because I will be so jealous of the fact that there's another woman with my husband, that whatever psychological factor, he says this with metaphors, but whatever psychological factor is keeping me from conceiving now will be released, and I'll be free to give birth. The idea of having a psychological factor affecting conception is a huge discussion that rages on to this day, and there it is, right in there in the pasuk. And finally, music, art, and biology. When I teach teachers how to teach in high school, I actually do try to do so in front of a piano or a little organ, and I show how the basic language of music, and I show clips I play some popular songs like classical songs like Moonlight Sonata or something, where I show that the song is moving in the framework of Shira. That the Shira of Devorah or of Moshe or of David speaks an Ikar language, because this was originally, it says Vatoshar Devorah. It says Oz Yoshir Moshe. These were, you know, we have traditions that were the way that the Baal Korah sings, Adyabor Amcha Hashem, Adyabor, that is actually how they sang on the spot. So that there is a certain parallelistic structure to Shira that makes its way into music. That the Tanakh, which is our Tanakh, is the source of I gave you 15 disciplines here. There are many more, right? So that emerges from so you have the Sforno I just mentioned, Yirmiyahu Chaf is before you, and Shoftim Perek Dalet. You have here just the simple repetition of. Like Shimu Melachim Ha'azinu Roznim, you know that A B A B. Shimu Melachim Ha'azinu Roznim. Shimu with Hazinu Melachim and Roznim. So that's basic structure of repetition is how music works, right? Now, if you look at art and biology, there's a beautiful picture of the Lamates Malachos, which I think some of you are doing now. So it shows that the artistry of HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling Bezalel and a few others to use your creativity, which until now was in the service of man, of Paro, I want you to use your creativity. How did these slaves know enough to build a Mishkan like this? So Shim Shriful Hirsch says it was within them. It's just that they were using it, making bricks, using it, just stomping on straw. And now that they were free to serve a Kaddish Baruch Hu, look how all these work too. So in the production of food, in the production of clothes, in the production of shoes, Hoseli Kol Tzarki, and the production of a home. The most basic of basic human needs. Translate the creativity of moving in those needs to the essence of belief in a Kaddish Baruch Hu that he created this world. That refrain from that creativity. I was trying to tell Bali Tshuva, it's not work that we're stopping. Putting on a light is hardly work, but it's creativity. So that this issue of Lamates Malachos works beautifully to teach us to translate the best of our creativity into a halachic setting and a halachic philosophical understanding. Finally, biology, this beautiful kliyakar. I'm just giving, these are just simple examples, but this beautiful kliyakar that says that it's good for your metabolism to sweat before eating. Because then that's what everyone says now, is that you burn the calories much more quickly. Right? So he says, before you eat lechem, sweat. Right? And the Sforno explains why Yosef gave bread, l'pi hataf. He rationed out bread to everyone because he says they were starving for a long time. And Nebuch, you know, in Bergen-Belsen, when they get the soldiers threw chocolate bars and bread and everything to the... And they're the ones who ate too quickly to burst their stomachs. And they managed to survive Bergen-Belsen, but not the liberators who threw food at them. So you say, listen, they're just hungry for 2 years. Their stomach's shrunk. If I give them food the way I can, Rav Kiyad HaMelech, they may kill them. Right? So here's it. I'm just saying, just to explain, there are others who explain why he gave lechem l'fi hataf in other ways. But here is a way to explain it in use of a biological issue. I conclude by saying, every day in the daily davening, we say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is poel gvuros, osech hadoshos, baal nechomos, areya tzedakos, matzmiach yeshuos, barir fuos, nerosilos, adon haniflos. So, forgive me for allow me to devise an interesting parish. It's something called the seven kofei aleches with earth. Have you ever heard this? That each one of these statements touches upon a different level of chokhmah and an aspect of the human existence that they were aware of in the ancient world. Each one was based on one of those stars. For instance, Mars was the ability to do battle. That would be Osama Baal Milchamos. Jupiter was Tzedek, was justice, Oset Tzedakos, right? So I'm sorry, Zorea Tzedakos. Each one of those, the moon was Yischachus, Poel Oset Chadoshos. So it shows that all sources of everything that we have can be found within this Tanakh. We just have to be adept at finding it and more adept at giving it over to I would say sometimes a skeptical student body. Sometimes they're very cool. They're in Gemara. They want to study. But when it comes to Tanakh, I'm sorry to say that it sometimes becomes an orphan in the curriculum and the amount of time we give. What I gave you here is just a very quick reference to how you can present. Most of these are available in multiple languages. And these are some of the books on stuff that you're likely to be teaching in a high school. And I do hope that I Rabbi Miller, that I touched upon the direction that I wasn't sure exactly of the title you wanted, but I hope that this touches upon maybe some of these chevra here will be expert teachers that might be called upon to teach some Tanakh as well. So I submit to you to try to use some of this derech in the glorious work that you will be performing in Yom HaShem.